because the latter third, from Perek Mem to Perek Samech, Samech Beis, are all about the comforts of Yemosa Mashiach. On the other hand, it's 22 prakim of it, and it's difficult to know exactly to do it pasuk by pasuk or the main ideas. So I'm in the process of figuring out how to do that best. But I thought that maybe for a few weeks we could do Megillas Rus, which would take us up to Shavuos, and then after Shavuos, which is already very good because that's already approaching the 3 weeks and the Haftaras of Comfort, that would be the ideal point to focus on that. So for the next few weeks, we'll do Megillas Rus. So if you want the Ice Scroll Chumash or whatever, that's right.
Could you at the beginning or the end just send that woman under
okay. Do you want the laws of Sphere?
In terms of what we practice and for okay. Avelos.
Okay, yeah, the actual Chumash right there, that has only the district. Okay. Yeah, okay, I was asked just to talk a little bit about the laws of Sphere very quickly. As you know, it's important to emphasize the following point that people are sometimes confused. The mitzvah of counting the Omer between Pesach and Shavuos is not intrinsically a sad time, it actually was a happy time, in anticipation of receiving of the Torah. There's nothing in the Torah that would indicate at all that there be any sadness or mourning associated with this period of time. The reason why we do observe mourning during this period of time is because of a later development, and this was the death of 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva. Chazal say that they died during the period of Pesach and Shavuos because of a plague. Other historians say they died as casualties of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. The Gemara might mean that as well. And they died because they did not show proper kavod and respect to each other. And that's what people say, well, gee, 24,000, okay, we had a Holocaust, and you know, why are we mourning 24,000? But it's not just those individuals. But rather, as we prepare to receive God's Torah, we have to foster within ourselves a sense of respect for each other, kavod for each other, unity for each other. Without that unity, which is predicated on seeing the good within another human being, we are not worthy of receiving God's Torah. Matan Torah required that there be ki'ish echad uvelev echad, one person, one heart. And that means looking at a person and seeing their essential value. The word kavod, and I said this last week, but just to repeat quickly, the word kavod, Rav Hirsch says, is related to kaved, which is heavy, meaning you look at a person and you see them as weighty, weighty, significant, having gravitas. In other words, it's not politeness or etiquette, it's an attitude of how you relate to another human being. And because of this, therefore, we mourn not just because we're mourning people's deaths, but we mourn to meditate and contemplate what caused that tragedy and how we can rectify it in our own lives. It's a much more personal message than just mourning some historical event. By the way, imagine this from Rabbi Akiva's perspective. You know the story of Rabbi Akiva, that he was an ignorant person. He was working for a very wealthy landowner, and the boss's daughter fell in love with him, and she sent him to learn in yeshiva. And at the age of 40, he was an illiterate shepherd who didn't know anything, and he started with the first graders. And for 12 years, he was learning, and then he comes back, and he overhears his wife say he'd go for another 12 years. So according to the story, he doesn't even say hello. And he comes back 24 years later with 24,000 students. Now, she was living in poverty all these years. Her father recommended her, so she married an ignoramus. And finally, imagine the joy that she feels, the 24 years of suffering and deprivation without a husband and living in poverty. And now she sees that everything, you know, was worth it. And yet, those are the 24,000 students who died. I mean, besides the enormity of the tragedy in and of itself, imagine what this said to Rabbi Akiva and his wife. Everything we worked for, destroyed. Everything we worked for is no longer there. So that's the 24,000 students. Now, they did not die for the entire period of the Omer. They only died for 33 days. And that's why we have many different minhagim as to how do we observe the mourning. Some people start from the second day of Pesach until Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day of the Omer. Others start from Rosh Chodesh till 3 days before Shavuos, which is 33 days. Others start after Rosh Chodesh, which is 2 days, and go until Erev Shavuos, which is 33 days. But your count is always going to be 33 days. By the way, according to all opinions, Lag BaOmer is the stopping. In other words, even if the mourning continues afterwards, Lag BaOmer is a freebie. Lag BaOmer is a hiatus. Now, because Chazal say that they did stop dying on the 33rd day of the Omer. Now, this is a very fascinating thing Kabbalistically, why they stopped dying on the 33rd day of the Omer. It's a little complicated, but you may notice this even in the Arts World Siddur. That is, every week of the Omer is connected with one particular Mida of God. There are seven primary Midos of God that are identified as the Spheros. Now, the Spheros are really 10 Spheros. The first three are called the intellectual Midos. That's Chachma, Bina, etc. But the latter seven are the emotive or the affective, the emotional attributes. And let me enumerate them. The first one is Chesed, loving kindness. The second one is Gevura, which is inner strength and discipline. The third is Tiferes, which is beauty. The fourth is Netzach, which is eternity or endurance. The fifth is Hod, which is glory. I'll try to explain what this is. The sixth is Yesod, which is foundation. And the seventh is Malchus, which is kingship. And in the way Kabbalah works is that God's powers are channeled into the world through these various manifestations. In life, there's the manifestation of loving kindness, and that's counterbalanced by the forces of restraint and discipline. Now, these are two opposite forces. When they blend in a perfect harmonious relationship, that gives you the force number three, which is Tiferes, beauty. Because what is beauty? The blending of the optimal mixture of Chesed and Gevura. Consider raising a child, right? If you're totally Chesed, kid does whatever they want to do, eat as much candy as they want to do, so you have to have a discipline and a restraint. Too much discipline turns into an abusive situation, right? So when there's the right Chesed and the right Gevura, you get what is called Tiferes. Now, I'll get to the other four in a second, but the truth is that even among these seven, there are the three primaries and the four secondaries. So the primary, as it were, mix that occurs in the world is the tension between Chesed and Gevura. Now, according to Chazal, our Avos exemplified these divine characteristics. Abraham exemplified in his life the extreme of loving kindness. And that's why he had a Yishmael, because too much Chesed can produce a Yishmael. Yitzchak represents the extreme of introspection, discipline, and restraint. And that's why there's an Esav. Yaakov represents the harmonization of Chesed and Gevura to achieve a state of optimal balance. And that is why all of Yaakov's children, in spite of their problems, I mean, they had problems indeed, but all of them were part of the Jewish people, because it is only the balance of Chesed and Gevura that creates perfection. And that is why Tiferes is also called Emes, truth. Because truth does not lie in extremities. Truth lies in balancing the opposing tensions. And in Kabbalah, is almost a very mechanical view of Torah and Mitzvahs, that certain things elicit the Chesed response. Then you got to do, like imagine you're pulling these machines and these levers, and certain things give you too much Gevura. So if you push this button, you're getting too much of that, you've got to push that button. And it takes a while till you get the appropriate buttons and switches that give you the balance in the world. The whole concept is to create this balance and harmony. Now, as I say, the primary balance and harmony is the Chesed and Gevura, culminating in Tiferes, in beauty. And there are times in the world where there might be too much Chesed, in which case Rishoyim could prosper, their evil does not get punished in any way. And there are times when there's a Midas Hadin in the world that's very, very powerful. Now, when we go to the second four, Netzach is endurance. The truth is, it is a reprise, it is a repetition of the first three on a different level. Netzach is said to be the embodiment of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, what's Moshe Rabbeinu? Moshe Rabbeinu emulates Chesed, but in a Gevura way. How is this? Because what does Moshe Rabbeinu give us? He gives us laws. He gives us guidance. He gives us structure. He's giving us things, but what he's giving us in an active sense is boundary and restriction. So that's a manifestation of Chesed in the context of giving restraint. Yeah.
The question is, Gura sounds very similar to the concept of giving rachamim from the Rosh Hashanah. Is that parallel?
It does parallel. However, interestingly enough, rachamim is said to be the midah of tiferes. It's very interesting. Chesed is the unrestrained giving. Unrestrained giving is not ultimately compassionate. Compare the child again. It is when the chesed has the appropriate boundaries that it turns into rachamim. So that's it. So tiferes is rachamim, not chesed. Now, netzach, therefore, is the chesed that gives us the strength to fight off that which is evil. Netzach, nitzachon, victory. And that's Moshe. Hod, glory, is the midah of Aaron. Now, what was Aaron's midah? Aaron's midah is to love peace and to pursue peace. And the midah of Aaron is when I step back and not impose myself on you to recognize your inner glory. So Hod is gevura in the sense of restraint, but it's a restraint to enable the other to shine. So if Netzach is the giving to you for purposes of imposing structure, Hod is a withdrawal like Gevura, but for the purpose of enabling you to shine. Now, Hod is good and bad. Hod is great because it enables me to give another person that freedom. But at the same time, in Aaron's own life, right? That's why Aaron did not take an aggressive stand for the sin of the golden calf. He kind of let people do what they do. So once again, the same tension that we have between the general impulse of giving and the impulse of holding back, which needs to be mediated by the balance of Tiferes, we repeat that with Netzach. Netzach is when I ply you with instructions and guidance and rules and regulations. Hod is when I step back and let you grow. Either of those two extremes are destructive. One is you're so overregulated that you choke and you're never able to express yourself. And the Hod is when I simply let you do what you want to do. It was an aggressiveness in terms of trying to bring people together. But the midah by which Aaron brought people together was he let people be what they were. And as a result, he let them shine. He let them feel important. He would go over to somebody and say, so-and-so wants to make up with you. In other words, what did Aaron say? Aaron didn't go over to a person and say, you did something wrong. Go and apologize. That's not what Zederich. He would go over to a husband and say, your wife wants to apologize to you. He would go over to the husband and say, your husband, in other words, what was he doing? He was not imposing on someone. He was giving a person a sense of their own chashivas. You know, this notion of structure, I once heard from a child psychologist a very interesting metaphor for this, about how children need structure. She said that to give a child like the right to make all decisions would be the same feeling we would have if we're on a 747 and the pilot goes over to us in the middle and says, you know, I'd like to take a nap for a while. Can you take over the plane? You know, it'll just be an hour, you know. Imagine what we would feel in that type of situation. So this is mediated by what's called foundation, and that's Yosef. Because Yosef, in his own life, represents a balance. Because Yosef, on one hand, got all of his instruction from Yaakov, his rules of living from Yaakov, and yet he was put in an arena where he had to do it himself in Mitzrayim. He didn't have someone standing over him. So that's the paradigm of the structure and the autonomy. Anyway, so you see what God is doing here is, God is constantly mixing paints and pigments. He has the chesed and gevurah, a constant of guidance versus autonomy. And when all of those mixtures take place, the revelation of those mixtures in the world is through what is called malchus, the kingship of God. Kingship, the Zohar says, is an empty vessel. Kingship is merely the sum total of everything that God mixes with those appropriate balances. And the balance that comes out of the machine depends on our mitzvos, our masim tovim. We determine how much of it is going to be a chesed, right? And in a Kabbalistic system, one pays very careful attention. See, it's not just do mitzvos, but rather which mitzvos and how they're done determines the quality of the product. It's a very mechanical understanding of what comes into the world. And that's why if you ever look at a Kabbalistic sitter, you will see, for example, that for Shemon Esrei, it might take 3 or 4 hours to daven Shemon Esrei, and it'll say Baruch, and there'll be 5 pages of meditations on what that Baruch does. When you blow the shofar 100 times, in a Kabbalistic sitter, not only, you know, we say, well, tekiah has a meaning. They say, no, every single tekiah has a different meaning. The first tekiah is different than the second tekiah. If you have 9 truos, each toot has a different meaning, and each time it's tooted, there's a different meaning to the 9. You see? So very, very intricate. That's why, you know, it takes hours and hours and hours to do these things. Now, the point I wanted to make is simply this. When we come to this counting of the Omer, each week is connected to one of those 7 attributes. The first week of Pesach is the week of Chesed, loving kindness. So it's Avraham's week. The second week of the Omer is the week of Gevura, inner strength and discipline, Yitzchak's week. The third week is the Midah of Tiferes, beauty, which is Yaakov's week. We're right now in we're in the third week, but we're in Yaakov's week. The fourth week is eternity, is Moshe's week. The fifth week is Aaron. The sixth week is Yosef. By the way, you see why the Kabbalah spheres do not go in chronological order. Yosef is number 6. Same thing with the Yushpizin, the guests of Sukkot, because the Yushpizin are based on this Kabbalistic idea. That's why those who change the Yushpizin to go chronological order are kind of mixing apples and oranges, because they're taking a Kabbalistic system which was not based on chronology, and they're trying to make it chronological. It doesn't work, because those people who are literal-minded, chronological people, didn't have the custom of Yushpizin. So it's kind of so the proper minhag would be Yosef would be the 6th, and the 7th week is Malchus, which is David. And remember, David represents the empty vessel, because David didn't even have his own life. David borrowed 70 years from Adam, and therefore David is only a conduit for divinity. Now here's the thing. Yeah. Say again? Netzach. Netzach is eternity or endurance. Then is Hod, which is glory, and Yesod is foundation, and Malchus. Now here's the thing. In fact, now you'll see something, I'll show you this in the Siddur. Not only does every week correspond to a Svira, but every day within the week corresponds to one of those things. So for example, the first day of Svira, which is the second day of Pesach, second night of Pesach, that is called Chesed of Chesed. It is the day of loving kindness, located in the week of loving kindness, the night of the second Seder. The second night of Pesach is the Gevura, is the discipline and restraint within the Chesed. Now, it's very hard to know what is the difference, let's say, between the second day of the first week, which is the Gevura of Chesed, and the first day of the second week, which is the Chesed in Gevura. These are complicated gradations to understand. But the point I just want to I want to point out to you, that's a fascinating thing, even if we don't fully understand this, and that is Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day of the Omer. What week and what day is the 33rd day of the Omer?
5 weeks was the day.
Not 5 weeks, it's 4 weeks.
Four weeks and the fourth day.
Fourth day and fourth week. No?
What week is that?
One second. There should be the fifth. I'm sorry. No. It should come out double out. 1 second.
It's 4 weeks, 5 days.
4 weeks, 5 days. So it's in the fifth week.
No. Yes.
4 weeks and 5 days.
Yes. 5 weeks.
4 weeks and 5 days.
It's in the fifth.
It's in the fifth week.
What I do?
Yes.
Oh, it's, you passed the fourth.
You're past. You're in the fifth week.
Okay.
Yeah. So the fifth week is the week of Aaron, and the fifth day in the fifth week is the day of Aaron. It is the glory of the glory. It is a double dose of Aaron. Now Aaron is the exemplar of the lover of peace and the pursuer of peace. Now the students of Rabbi Akiva died, because they did not show proper kavod to each other. But the day in which Aaron's presence becomes most dominant is a day in which kavod suffuses the world, as it were. The students of Rebbe Akiva don't die anymore because we absorb the lesson of showing kavod for each other. So it's no accident why the one day that the students of Rebbe Akiva died was indeed, I'm sorry, they stopped dying rather, was the day of the 33rd day of the Omer. Because if the Aveira was not showing kavod zelazeh, which is the opposite of Aaron HaKohen's Midah, the day of the fifth week, right, during the fifth week, the fifth day, is Hod Sheba Hod, it's called. That is why they stopped dying. That's the Koach of Lag BaOmer. And that's why there's tremendous joy. You know, last year I was fortunate to be in Eretz Yisrael for Lag BaOmer, and if any of you were ever there, you know that Meiron, which is up north, right near Tzfat, is the place to go for Lag BaOmer. And again, I don't know if I would do it every year, but I think once in your life, you know, you have to go. You know, it's just unbelievable. I mean, there must be 500,000 people there going for 24 hours. And of course, as this happens in Israel, you know, everything becomes commercialized. So around 2 miles, you know, Shimon Yochai's kever, you know, is there. Around 2 miles before the kever, the buses have to let you off. And it turns into a just tremendous open air market. So you can buy refrigerators, you can buy, you know, you can buy anything you want to buy, and people are showing, you know, Shas videos and all sorts of, you know, videos of this scandal and that scandal, and Lubavitcher Rebbe davening Shacharis. They take a video of just davening Shacharis, so you can watch the Rebbe daven Shacharis. You know, so it goes on. So you really have to, you know, you walk around a mile and a half through crowds of, you know, as I say, probably 500,000 people. And I remember I was holding on to my son, and I basically said, you know, we have to hold on here, I can't lose you. And at some point, you know, people are pushing through, and I wouldn't let go, and they wouldn't let go. I was like a football player. You know, I just rammed them, you know. It's like the only way you could get through at some point.
Your elbows in his head.
Yeah, you know. But, as you know, Meiron is where Shimon Bar Yochai is buried. And he was the greatest student of Rabbi Akiva. And according to tradition, he also died on Lag BaOmer. And the day that he died, he revealed the secrets of the Zohar, because he wrote the Zohar to his students. And it becomes a day of great joy. Even though in many cases a Yahrzeit is supposed to be a sad day. And yet his Yahrzeit was supposed to be a day of great revelation. But part of it also is because Lag BaOmer is connected to Hod Sheba Hod, the special Koach of Aaron. Now, in terms of the halachos here, as I say, the halachos basically are only twofold. There are only two laws in Shulchan Aruch that are mentioned you don't do during the mourning period. One is we don't cut our hair, either haircuts, and then shaving, and the like. And the other is we do not get married. Now, it's very interesting. Those are the only two things that are mentioned. We do not get married during the Avelis period. It does not say in the Shulchan Aruch, you're not allowed to listen to music. Now, let me explain this, because people get a wrong impression. So people often say, where does it say in the Shulchan Aruch? I remember years ago, someone asked me, where does it say in the Shulchan Aruch that you can't listen to music during the Omer period? And I looked and I looked and I looked, and I couldn't find it. It doesn't say anywhere. However, you know why it doesn't say it anywhere? Because there's another chapter in the Shulchan Aruch that actually says that after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, you're never allowed to listen to music. So, you know, from the perspective of the Shulchan Aruch, there was nothing special about the Omer period for music, because you can never listen to music. Zecher l'Churban. So Rav Moshe writes that the Shulchan Aruch does not mention not listening to music because there was nothing unique about the Omer period. You couldn't do it anytime. Now, Rav Moshe says, since our custom is that we commonly listen to music, it is proper that during the Omer period, whatever the Avelis is, one does refrain. But there are many, many issues about that. There are many issues such as live music versus radio or tape or CD. And some say it only applies to live music. It doesn't apply to recorded music. Our minhag is, however, that we try to refrain from recorded music as well. Now, people often ask, you know, there are two minhagim. You start from the second day of Pesach or after Rosh Chodesh. if you're starting from a tabula rasa, if you're starting from an empty slate, I would recommend everybody to start from the second day of Pesach. I'll tell you why. Because there are many opinions that say that even if you begin your Omer Avelos from the second day of Pesach, the music restrictions don't apply during Chol HaMoed because it's a Yom Tov. So consequently, if you start from the second day of Pesach, you gain 7 more days. Well, not Yom Tov, but you gain more days that you can listen to music. Your net number of deprivation days are going to be less if you start from the second day of Pesach. So that would be a certain advantage starting from there. Now, another thing, it does not say in the Shulchan Aruch you're not allowed to buy things. People say, am I allowed to buy new items during the Omer period? Now, people are confusing this with the 3 weeks. It says during the 3 weeks from Shivas or Batamas, you don't buy objects for which you would recite a Shechiyanu, like new clothes, a new dress, or whatever it is. However, that really does not apply during Svira. During Svira, you are allowed to make a Shechiyanu and buy new things. This only applies during the 3 weeks. Now, a final issue, which is very important, this comes up a lot, and Rav Moshe has a wonderfully important tshuva on this. That is, let's say I'm invited to a chasna, which is occurring when it's my mourning period, but it's not the mourning period of the bride and the groom. For example, let's assume that I keep the Omer period starting from the second day of Pesach. The chasna and the kala don't keep it until Rosh Chodesh. And they get married right after Pesach, and I'm invited to their wedding. Am I allowed to go to their wedding if, for me, there's already a mourning period? Or the opposite, let's say they keep it from the second day of Pesach till Lag BaOmer, and they make a wedding after Lag BaOmer. I keep it from Rosh Chodesh to the 3 days before Shavuos, so for me it's an Avelos period. Am I allowed to go to a wedding that's during my mourning period if it's not during their mourning period? So Rav Moshe writes, you are allowed to. Rav Moshe says, as long as they are permitted to make their wedding, of course, if it's a non-religious wedding, it's not following the Omer period, you can't, but if they are allowed to make their wedding, you are allowed to go to the wedding, even though you'll be listening to music. And he even says, for men, they would be allowed to take a shave if they don't look that good. So the Isser is to make the wedding, to get married. The Isser is not to go to a wedding that the chasna and the kala are allowed to make. So that's something people should be aware of. So the issue people always ask, gee, I got this invitation to a wedding, can I go? The answer is, yeah, you can always go, because there is no issue to go to a wedding at all during the Sefira period. That's to be contrasted, by the way, with real mourning. When chas v'shalom, a person is a real avel for a parent, then of course you cannot go to the wedding. But this is not as chomer as real avel.
I've got a new wrinkle. In two cases, people who were making weddings during Sefira, when they were able to make a wedding, were told that if the Washington area minhag keep the first half of Sefira, they could not make it in fall in Washington. They had to go to Baltimore. Can you?
I did hear that a while ago. I think basically, I don't want to comment on this. Basically, it was something that Rabbi Klavan's father did many, many years ago. It was forgotten for many, many years, but Rabbi Klavan now feels it's a matter of kibbutz of the aim that it should be respected. I mean, it was really a very dormant minhag, but he wants to bring it back.
Even people who are not part of the obligated?
Well, Rabbi Klavan Sr. was really chief rabbi of Washington, so in that sense, that became like a community unit. Although it was dormant for many years, but Rabbi Klavan wants to be a bad cleaner, so we might as well go along. Yeah. Okay, so that's I don't know if you had any music questions. That's just the basic halacha. Yeah.
So regardless, is there any minhag within Washington?
Yeah, well, again, the suggestion was made that there had been a custom in Washington around 60 years ago that you begin from the second day of Pesach and you go until Lag BaOmer. So, and of course, because of my music reason, I would suggest that that's a good minute to follow. So if you have no definitive custom, that would be a good custom to follow. And, again, I have my doubts whether we can qualify as a community minute, but it's arguably the closest thing we have, and therefore you could follow that.
I understand that community minute, in fact, it's not your personal minute.
Well, sure, the halakha is very clear. Again, we don't have it in America very much, but certainly in halakha there's absolutely a concept.
But here,
in America it's very rare, unless you have, you know, sub-communities like Hasidim, Lubavitch, Breslev, you know, they have things.
What about Buster? You know, I'm
feeling
like hanging
out
and I never
heard of it. All right, you know, I don't want to get... Well, I'll tell you, Batzer Chutz is basically a rule that was adopted at a time when the hashgachos were very poor, that nothing could be served in a synagogue in Washington unless it was approved under the Rabbinical Council of Washington. So the fact that the OU or the Star K approved it would not be allowed. Now, the truth is, I mean, officials to date is the only casualty of that system right now, because what the VAD here now does is,
right,
they now give simultaneous hashgachas. So as far as I know, virtually any Star K caterer in Baltimore now has a simultaneous Rabbinical Council of Washington endorsement. So there is no problem. So official is the last holdout. So that creates a certain amount of problems. But Batzer Chutz originated for a very, very good reason. The question is whether it's still outlived its usefulness, but the reason was because there was a time in which the kashrus in America was much, much worse than it was today, and there were all sorts of people who were not giving good hashgachas. They were certifying things without checking them out, and the rabbis here wanted to be sure that everything that went through was a proper hashgachah.
I thought it was also a kind of a commercial. In other words, to protect
if someone wants to write a doctoral dissertation on it, no, that would be an interesting question. The question is, no, you're right, the question is, was it predicated on economic protectionism, or was it predicated on kashrus? Again, there's a machlokas about it.
It's
a machlokas, maybe it's both. You know, I mean, again, I, you know, it has... it has no legitimate reasons. This, I mean, it was properly motivated, and it served a very useful function. There is a question whether, when you have organizations like the Star K and the OU, and the Chaf K and the OK, whether there's a continuing need. So this is being debated. It's being debated by the Rabbanim in town, whether there's still a particular reason for it. And even, you know, I do know, I mean, even with officials, there are loopholes, so to speak, because the Yisr of Batzer Chutz refers to a limitation on the utilization of a caterer, but it does not prohibit you to buy food in Baltimore and bring it to Washington, right? So, yeah, so it's okay, it has its complications.
It's political.
Planting during Sfira, I don't think so. You're not allowed to plant during Chol HaMoed, but during the Omer itself you can plant. I'm sorry, choosing the what?
From the saying that where did that
Who says that?
The idea that you have to
the morning. Oh, no, no. So the Gemara in Yavama says specifically, the Gemara in Yavama says that they died for 33 days during the Omer. It does not say they died the whole period. That's in the Gemara itself. Now, I want to emphasize, just to be sure people understand this, the Gemara does not say that we mourn during the Omer. The Gemara just records a historical fact. The concept that because of that historical fact we engage in Avelus is post-Talmudic. It dates no earlier than the time of the Gaonim. It is not in the Gemara. The Gemara records the fact of their death. The Gemara does not record the conclusion that we draw from that. And of course, I should also emphasize, too, that as you know, the mourning, well, it's very interesting. You could trace historically how the fact that the mourning restrictions were much more severe among Ashkenazic countries than Sephardic countries. And the reason was very simple, because in the course of time, many of the Crusades and many of the massacres connected with the Crusades, which were in France and Germany, etc., did occur during the months of Iyar and Sivan, which are the months of Sfira. And as a result, much of the Avelus of the Omer was not just connected to Rabbi Akiva, but also to the Crusades, which did not affect the Sephardic countries to the same extent. In fact, the prayer Av HaRachamim that we recite every most Shabbos, that is a prayer for the martyrs who died al Kiddush Hashem, and that was composed at the time of the First Crusade. And according to some, the original minhag was Av HaRachamim was only recited in the month of Iyar in Sivan. It later spread. But that's why you'll notice, for example, Shabbos Rosh Chodesh or Shabbos Mevorachim, we normally do not say Av HaRachamim. During Sfira we do, but not because of Rabbi Akiva Tzidkus, but because Av HaRachamim was written for those months, the months of the First Crusade. We say it the whole year. Oh, you don't say it at all? Okay. Well, again, as I say, it's connected to the Crusade. So again, the Sephardic communities were not affected. Yeah. No. It's the same thing. It's only those 33 days. And Lag BaOmer is a hiatus. Now, this year, by the way, it's a little unusual. Because Rosh Chodesh Iyar was Friday and Shabbos. So when you have a combination of Kavod Shabbos and the joy of Rosh Chodesh, you were allowed to cut your hair this Friday. Yes. This past Friday. Sorry. Sorry, I forgot to tell you. No, it's Svardim don't. But again, I mean, there are people who don't begin Avelos till after Rosh Chodesh. So they had no problem at all. But even those who began the second day of Pesach could cut when Erev Shabbos is Rosh Chodesh Sivan.
When we say that the students of Rabbi Akiva weren't respectful to each other, I mean, are we talking about things along the magnitude of what we find today between the different
Yeah, I think it's inconceivable that the students of Rabbi Akiva were rude to each other and insulted each other. I think that clearly was not it. But rather it means according to their madrega, that's why I said kavod is to see in the other person something significant. Now I can be very polite to somebody, I could be very nice to somebody, but I don't see anything that they have to offer me. So it was a much more of an internal thing that Hashem saw in their heart, that they weren't machshiv the other person properly. So it's not a question, again, it's important that we understand this. Kavod Habrios, the idea of kavod, is not simply being nice to people. It's to genuinely look at them and see that there is something valuable in what they have to offer, what they bring to the table. If you don't have that sense of kavod, no matter how nice you are, there's a chisaron in one's kavod Habrios. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz used to say, like, Habedes Avicha Vezimecha. He said a beautiful thought, honor your father and mother. He says the following: kavod requires that you identify in your mind something that is unique and special about your parents. In other words, he says it's not enough to be nice, to be an obedient person. You are mechuyev to, and again, hopefully for most of us that should be easy. Sometimes for some people it might be hard, but you are mechuyev to focus your mind on what is significant and good and enduring about your father and mother. That is what kavod is. Because it's not just a question of, they're worthless, but I'll be nice anyway. You know, that's not the concept. The concept is to identify their chashivas. Yeah.
It sounds very difficult to accept that 24,000 students of a great man like Rabbi Akiva,
right, that's the paradox.
Right, and it's very difficult to understand. Yeah. And that there weren't any exceptions.
Well, there were 5 survivors, so apparently, yeah, there. Yeah, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, they were there. Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua, these were great. Rabbi Tarfon, these were great rabbis who did survive, but only five. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua, Rav Shimon ben Yochai. I was one of them that survived. I think Rabbi Tarfon. I don't remember. Yeah.
Are there any reasons
to require to show the idea of kavod, right? Clearly, we have to have kavod for our parents. Chazal say b'feirish that a husband must have kavod for his wife. It's very interesting. The Gemara's lashon is Ohava kegufo, a man must love his wife like he loves himself. Umechabda, and have kavod for her, yoser migufo, more than he has kavod for himself. The Gemara does not say it the other way around. The Rambam says it both ways. The Rambam introduces the reciprocity. The Gemara only emphasizes that one direction. there is, interestingly enough, no specific rule, thou shalt honor thy children. It does not say that. So you can't point to a verse. However, I think that the general, if the idea of kavod is to see that which is worthy and good, I think it's very clear that psukim like training a person, chanoch lenar, training a child according to his way, connotes the notion of finding that way. So I think the kavod for children is an implicit idea that you find in many, 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 many places. Absolutely, that's kavod habriyos. Kavod habriyos meaning honoring all of Hashem's creatures. In fact, that phrase would even connote animals, although as far as I know, there's no mitzvah of kavod for animals. We're not allowed to give pain to animals, but I think kavod refers to God, to the those that are in the image of God, which are human beings. Because again, when you honor a human being, you are honoring the godliness that is within them. You are honoring Hashem. And when you disparage a human being, you are disparaging the godly image that is in that human being. So you're spitting in Hashem. That's right. So it's all one thing. So this is the thing that you'll notice. You know, if you look at Gedolim, one thing you'll notice, I mean, there are many things you notice about a Gadol, of course, but one thing you'll notice about Gedolim is the enormous amount of kavod that they show to everybody. Everybody, people, Jew and non-Jew. I mean, the concept that you hear sometimes, racist remarks or remarks that denigrate non-Jews, you never hear anything like that from the mouth of an Adam God. Not only don't you hear something insulting, but they go out of their way to talk to the janitors and to the secretaries and to the orderlies, the people, I don't want to say the lowly people because they're not lowly, but the people that we sometimes disregard because they're not of any particular prestige. You know, but you find that the Gedolim always make them comfortable. I remember when Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was nifter. Apparently, he lived in Muncie across the street from a convent. And, you know, after he was nifter, so one of the yeshiva boys around there was walking, and he bumps into a nun, full of regalia, you know, black habit. And he's a little shocked, you know, the nun, the crucifix, you know. And she says, "Could you tell me what happened to the old rabbi that used to live here?" And he's wondering, like, why is she asking me about this old rabbi? She said, "Well," so he told her, "he died." And she says, "Oh, because every time he would see us, he would always ask how we're doing and talk to us for a few minutes." Now you can imagine how many yeshiva boys stop to talk to a nun. You can rest assured that there's nobody he spoke to, you know. But he would ask her how she was doing, you know. And if there would be a funeral procession of even a non-Jew, he would always stop what he was doing and walk for 4 amos after the funeral procession. Right? The notion of kavod. And that's why, again, as I say, one of the unfortunate things we sometimes have in our chinuch is a denigration of others, and that's not good. You know, basically, you sell Yiddishkeit by building up what we have, not by cutting down or disparaging what other people have. That's not a good way of advancing things. Well, there's something I may have mentioned this, but it's actually a very, very nice thing. Somebody in Lubavitch put out a calendar, I think it's called, it's like a little pamphlet, 49 days. And he goes with this thing that every week there's a theme, Chesed Gevura, and every day there's a theme. And he actually gives you an exercise, a meditation, one paragraph meditation, for every day of the Omer corresponding to, you know, Chesed is the love and Gevura is the week of discipline, you know. And something to think about. So actually it's a very nice thing. Now again, as I say, some of it is obviously just speculation. Like when he tries to differentiate between the loving kindness of discipline and the discipline of loving kindness, you know, it gets a little, you know, it's not clear that these are valid distinctions. But nevertheless, he does give you day to day. I mean, the main thing we meditate on, well, the two things. The general meditation is to work on seeing the kavod in each other. And I should emphasize that seeing the kavod in each other also means seeing the kavod within yourself. This is also a very fundamental point. You know, love your neighbor or love your friend as you love yourself presupposes, as has been pointed out many times, that you love yourself. Because if you hate yourself, then feeling towards others as you feel towards yourself is not going to help very much. Yeah, I feel the same towards everybody. I hate them all. You know, that doesn't do. So ironically, there has to be a certain amount of self-regard in order to see it in others, in that sense. And if I could just repeat something I said in Shul yesterday, it's very interesting. You know, we read the whole pasuk, V'yahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your friend as you love yourself. So there's one interesting pshat. Now the word is reyacha. Reyacha. Now we know there are two words for friend. There's reya and chaver. And what is the difference between a reya and a chaver? So one of the famous biblical commentaries of the 19th century, the Ksava HaKabbalah, it's a well-known sefer, it's not used that much today, but very, very fine sefer, says the following. Chaver comes from lechaber. Lechaber is to unite, to bring together. Reya comes from leroeya, which is to break up and to separate. So he says, chaver is a friend who thinks like me, who is exactly like me. The Torah does not say, love your chaver as you love yourself, because that's obvious. Of course I love a chaver. He thinks like me, I'm always right. But the reya is the human being who sees the world differently, the one who does not have your viewpoint. The Torah says, don't only love the chaver, love the reya. And that's why it's even connected to ra. It's a funny thing. Reya is a friend, but there's a ra there. There's a certain animosity that might be there, and you have to surmount it. By the way, that is why husband and wife are called in Sheva Brachas Re'im Ho'ahuvim. Not Chaverim, but Re'im, because the concept of a husband and wife also is that they are different personalities. They see the world differently. It is the creative tension between them that leads to growth. You don't want to marry a, well, maybe you want to, but you shouldn't marry a clone. Couldn't have a same-sex clone anyway. But the reason is because how will there be growth if each of you will just confirm each other's prejudices and weaknesses? Right? Every person has weaknesses. So you marry somebody with the same faults, which we sometimes do. So what's going to happen? We'll just reinforce. On one hand, we might reinforce our good points, which is good, but we'll also reinforce our bad points. There's not going to be any transformation. There's not going to be any growth. But when each one sees the world differently, then each one can gain from the other. That's why it says, Ezer Kenegda, marriage is described as helpmate, which is opposite. So Chazal say, helpmate or opposite? Which one is it? So the answer is, if you're lucky, it's help. And if you're not lucky, it's opposite. That's one answer. But the other answer, it says in the Hasidic Sfarim, is it is the kenegdo. It is the opposition. Loving opposition. Or the British have the term loyal opposition. Now, there is an opposition in which you support each other and you care about each other, but you are willing to offer a different vantage point that creates the transformation and the growth. You know, there's a toy you can get in an airport. It's a wind-up toy for beleaguered junior executives who are always being criticized. And this toy is like a man that goes back and forth and says, you're great, you're wonderful, you're always right, your ideas are 100%. And so, you know, there is a need for those toys. Indeed. You know, people sometimes need to get this feedback, which they are positive stroking. And there's no question in a relationship that it's very important. I mean, I don't mean at all, you know, I mean, people need to, you know, if they had a hard time in the office, they need, you know, the spouse, whether it's husband or the wife, to say, you know, you're a good person, and don't take it too hard. But at the same time, the way we really help each other sometimes is by pointing out where we have gone astray and how we could look at things differently, because otherwise, you know, there are going to be no transformations. So, how did I get on this? Am I God? Oh, yes. So that's the word reya. Now, one other thing about this. That's reya versus chaver. But another thing is that, remember the story with Hillel? This is what I said yesterday in show. Hillel, the non-Jew, tells Hillel, teach me the whole Torah on one foot. So Hillel tells him, what is hateful to you, do not do to the other. And the rest is commentary. So the Christians make a big point that why does Hillel accentuate the negative? After all, you know, Jesus said, love your fellow person. Hillel just says, don't hurt. Don't hurt. Why doesn't he give a message of love? And you find that there's a great discussion that the New Testament is based on positive morality and the Old Testament is based on negative morality. Obviously, it's a distortion because those very words that Jesus quotes are from the Chumash. You should love your friend. So the question becomes, it's a good question, why does Hillel change it from a positive to a negative? Isn't positive a higher level? And one of the answers is this. One of the answers, there's a very deep psychological insight here. Sometimes we are so anxious to show our love, to do good in the world, that we never bother to ask ourselves, is our good doing more good than harm, or more harm than good? Meaning, we never step back to see the individuality and uniqueness of the person that we're trying to help. We have this preconceived notion of what we think is good for them, and we're going to shove it down their throats, whether it's right for them or not. And therefore, Hillel's message to the guy is, you want to do good, the first thing you have to be sure is you're not doing bad. Indeed, there's a profound lesson there. Because the world has been affected very much by do-gooders who have a certain vision. I mean, after all, if you think about this, I mean, Pol Pot, let's take, I'm thinking Pol Pot, and I can go back to Hitler too. But, you know, Pol Pot, I mean, it was just amazing because he was this nice teacher in the early 1970s who was teaching political science, and everyone that remembered him as a kind, very patient person. And how does he turn into something not like Hitler? Hitler was you know, crazy to begin with from a very young age. But his Pol Pot, I mean, well into his 40s, he was a very civilized, kind person. And then he winds up killing, I don't know how many people, 2 million people. And he did it because he convinced himself that he would be building a better society. That he said he could create so much good that he has to destroy whatever stands in his way. So Hillel's message to the guy is, before you go around doing good and transforming the world, be sure you understand. See the humanity of the people that you're dealing with. Step back. Be sure you don't do harm. So the negative is very important. In fact, even in Christian love, right? Well, what has been the great contribution of Christian love in the world? You know, I mean, love thy neighbor as thyself, you know, has resulted in crusades and all sorts of things. So it's not so bad. So negative morality isn't so bad, you know. Maybe you step back and be sure you're not hurting people before you go out and try to help them with your version of what is considered to be beneficial. So that's something to think about. Now, the other aspect of it is, even psychologically, is the need to have patience. Meaning, the non-Jew is being told by Hillel, take your time. Meaning, first learn how not to hurt people, and then go out. Meaning, we're often in spiritual life, we have a tremendous impatience for instant results. And in spiritual growth, you have to go slowly. Master the basics, and then go up and up and up, instead of trying to jump to the highest levels. Rav Yisrael Salanter used to talk about people's impatience to become tzaddikim. He had said that everybody wants to learn Shas in their life, the whole Talmud. He said, well, that's possible. That's a reasonable possibility. But then he says, but people want to learn Shas in one night. So he says, that's only possible if you're the Vilna Gaon. Then he says, but there are people who want to learn Shas in one night and get 8 hours of sleep the same night. That, he says, even the Vilna Gaon couldn't do. You know, so if you want to do everything all at once, he says those things are not, those things are simply not possible. So there are some profound lessons in the negatives over there. But that's the Ahavta L'Reach as well. By the way, just one final thought that we have here. And that is, Hillel gives the answer, what is hateful to your friend, do not do. Now, why is that the whole Torah? At most, that only embraces the commandments Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. That doesn't embrace the commandments between man and God. Hillel didn't, I mean, the guy said, teach me the whole Torah on one foot. Hillel only gives him an answer that maybe encapsulates half of the Torah, but it doesn't encapsulate the other half. So Rashi answers that. Rashi says, when Hillel says, what is hateful to you, do not do to your friends, your friend includes God as well. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is also your friend. Which is a very interesting way of looking at mitzvahs. I don't want to do things wrong because I'm going to hurt my friend. I'm going to cause tsar to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it's not a question of fear. It's a question of not wanting to cause pain to someone that, to Hashem that I love and I care about, because He loves and cares about me. So that's just, again, those are the things you think about in the Yomer. The Yomer is primarily concerned with this mitzvah of Yahavtu L'Reacha Kamocha. And as I say, in the Lubavitch calendar at least, there are specific meditations that are key to each day based on this Kabbalah idea of the seven lower spheros, and each day in the week is also connected to those lower spheres. Now you'll see, by the way, the art scroll is an art scroll sitter. After every day of the Omer, it'll give it a designation: Chesed of Chesed, Gevura of Chesed, etc. It'll give you the key of the day of the week and the particular week that it is. Okay, now there is a machlok. The women technically are not obligated in the mitzvah of counting the Omer, because it is a time-bound commandment. But like all other mitzvahs, if their custom is to do it, they can recite a bracha, just like it's a Sparta mount. Sorry, do not recite a bracha. Sparta do not make a voluntary bracha. Yeah.
What is all that?
Yeah, well, the issue is a technical issue, because the Torah describes the mitzvah as you shall count 7 complete weeks. So the question is, if you miss a day, it's no longer a complete counting. So you're not able to make a bracha. That's basically it. It's a question of, does tamimos require that you do it? That's why, for example, even the first night of Shavuos, we have to daven Ma'ariv late. We can't make Yom Tov early. The reason is because Shavuos has to come after 49 complete days. So until we finish the 49 days, we're not allowed to daven Ma'ariv early. Yeah, so obviously, obviously there's a word missing there, that it basically says you have to count up to the 50th, because you have to complete a counting that brings you up to 50. It's similar, we find a similar problem by lashes. You know, if somebody transgresses a negative commandment, they get beaten 39 times. That's Malkus. So the Torah actually says, Arboim Yakenu, you hit him 40 times, but we interpret you hit him up to, so you have a similar idea of odds. Ad v'lo ad bichlal. You know, I remember a few years ago there was this teenager, American kid in Singapore, who they have caning there. So they were discussing 4 times or 5 times, different things. You know, I was just thinking, he was lucky he wasn't debased him. But you get 39 times. That's much, much rougher. Okay. All right. So I don't know if there's anything else about Omer that I could. Okay. Yeah, so again, as I say, for the next a few weeks, we will do Megillat Rus, and then we will get back to the Nechamos of Yeshayahu, the comforts of Yeshayahu. And let's see, Chumash Masechta. What's that? I'm not going to read this verse by verse, but just I just want to give some introductory remarks. So Rus is much easier, safer to get through than some of the longer form, because it is short. It is 4 prakim, and it is really a single story. The following: who wrote Megillas Rus? As you probably know, Rus was actually written by Shmuel Hanavi. Shmuel Hanavi wrote the story of Rus, and he wrote the story of Rus towards the end of his life, when he had already anointed David as Melech. Remember, Shmuel anointed Shaul as Melech, and in Shmuel's lifetime, Shaul was found to be unfit, because he did not carry out the commandment to kill Amalek, and Shmuel anointed David, who did not, of course, become king until after Shmuel died. And the purpose of Megillas Rus was to trace the lineage of David HaMelech. So, if you want to know, what is the main reason for Rus? The main reason for the story of Rus is the very end of the Megillah, which gives us a little yichus list, a lineage list, going all the way back. In fact, look at Perek Dalet Pasuk Yitches. Let's be sure everybody knows all the names. Ela Toldos Peretz. This is Perek Dalet Pasuk Yitches. These are the generations, or the children, of Peretz. Now, who is Peretz? You don't know, right? You have to know the Chumash for this. In other words, Megillas Rus presupposes that you remember Chumash Bereishis. And if you remember, Yehuda impregnated his daughter-in-law, Tamar, not knowing she was his daughter-in-law. And Tamar had twins. And one twin was coming out first, and the other twin pulled him back in and came out first. And the one that broke through, is called Peretz. Peretz means to break through. And it was known then, or it was, there was a nevuah then, that this is the attribute of Malchus, because one of the things that a king can do is a king can break down walls for eminent domain and the like. And therefore, Peretz is the son of Yehuda. So it starts off, Peretz gave birth to a man, Chetzron. Chetzron gave birth to a man, Ram. Ram gave birth to Aminadav. These are relatively unknown names. Aminadav gave birth to Nachshon. This is somebody famous. This is the famous Nachshon ben Aminadav, who was the Nasi of the tribe of the Yehuda in the desert, and he was the one who jumped into the Red Sea before it split, up to his neck, and the water split. And it was in the zechus of his emuna that Hashem did a miracle for Klal Yisrael. Now, Nachshon gave birth to Salma, who's also called Salmon, then the name changes. Salmon gave birth to Boaz. Okay, so this is important. Boaz was a grandson of Nachshon ben Aminadav. Oh, not at all. Not at all. Nachshon is in the Chumash, yeah. The only thing is that the Chumash does not say that Nachshon jumped into the Red Sea. That's a medrash. But Nachshon is mentioned in Bamidbar as the head of the... I'll go into that in great length. I just want to show you the yichus. Yeah, I'll discuss that. Yeah. So again, I just want to show you the yichus here. So Nachshon gave birth to Salma. Salmon, again a little variation which is common in Tanakh, gave birth to Boaz. Boaz from Rus already gave birth to Oved. That was the child that they had at the end of the story. Oved gave birth to Yishai. Actually, I shouldn't say gave birth, because obviously the mothers gave birth. But the English is holid caused. Holid is caused to be born. Not that gave birth. Yeah. And Yishai caused David to be born. Now, it doesn't mention, obviously, it doesn't mention any of the wives. Even Boaz and Rus, which is the whole story, at the end, it follows the male, the son. But the point that these last psukim are designed to do is to establish the lineage of David HaMelech. Now, why was Shmuel, just forget about Shavuos for a second, because reading Rus during Shavuos is a much later development. But why was Shmuel interested in expounding on the Yichus of David HaMelech? So our Svarim tell us, because throughout David HaMelech's life, there was an accusation that he was not a kosher Jew. Because in the Torah it says, in Parshas Kisetzi, in the book of Devarim, Lo Yavo Amoni Umoavi B'Kal Hashem. An Ammonite and a Moabite are not allowed to enter into the congregation of God. Now again, who are Ammon and Moab? Again, you have to remember the Chumash. Go back to Lot. Lot and his daughters were saved from Sodom, miraculously. And Lot's daughters see a tremendous destruction. They thought they're the last two people, or last two women alive in the world. And the older daughter got her father drunk, and she had intercourse with her father. She became pregnant, gave birth to a child, and somewhat with a lack of tznias, she called the child Moav, which means from my father. I'm sorry. The second daughter did the same thing, and there was a conception, and the child was called Ammon, from my nation, slightly more tzniastic. Those nations of Ammon and Moab, where did they live? They eventually became nations, and they inhabited the east bank of the Jordan, but not the land that the 2.5 tribes had. That was the land of Sichem. This was land that the Jewish people were told not to conquer. We were told, do not conquer the land of Ammon and Moab. I gave that to Lot's children. And only when Mashiach comes we'll get the extra land of Ammon and Moab. Now, you would think, why does the Torah say Ammon and Moab are excluded from joining Klal Yisrael? Because they came from incest? No, that's not the reason. That wouldn't have excluded them. Years later, when we're wandering in the deserts, and we need to go into Eretz Yisrael, we want to cross the Jordan, and we wanted access to the territory of Ammon and Moab, and we asked them for food and water, and they refused, and we had to circle Ammon and Moab, and that's why we entered up north where Yericho is. That's where we crossed the Jordan, because we couldn't gain access through the territory of Ammon and Moab. So the Torah says, because of this, the Ammonite and the Moabite, even if they want to convert, they cannot be admitted to the congregation of God. Al devar asher lo kidmu eschem balechem uvamayim, because they did not offer you food and water, which you were willing to pay for when you were leaving Egypt. And also, they were responsible for hiring Bilam. Balak, the king of Moab, hired Bilam to curse. Now, Rav Eliyahu Kitov makes a beautiful point. He makes the following points. L'chaira, if we take other nations, Egyptians, if the ancient Egyptians wanted to convert, they are permitted upon the third generation. That is a grandson of an Egyptian convert. Even Amalek, the Rambam understands, an Amalekite could convert to Judaism. Now, the Amalekites tried to destroy us. The Egyptians enslaved us. And yet there is no nation that is so totally rejected from Klal Yisrael as Ammon and Moab. On one hand, we're not allowed to hurt them. There's no mitzvah to destroy them, and it's exactly the opposite. We are commanded not to wage war with them unless they attack us. So we don't hurt them in any way, but we totally separate. And why is this so? And he makes the point. Because Ammon and Moab were the descendants of Lot that Avraham Avinu had shown so much kindness for. And at a minimum, they should have had in their hearts gratitude towards the descendants of Avraham. Amalek was the opposite. Amalek comes from Esav, who was rejected. So even though Amalek is a Russia, but at least Amalek has the rejection which allows it to be a Russia. And Rav Kitov points out, therefore, we see that not having Hakaras HaTov to your benefactor is such a repulsive, disgusting mida that it cannot be allowed to infiltrate the Jewish people. It is worse than Amalek. Amalek hates us and destroys us, but at least they have a reason. I mean, not a reason, but at least they have some negative thing we did to them. We took away their brachos. With Ammon and Moab, all they received was kindness, and all they give back is cruelty. The lack of Hakaras HaTov is why Ammon and Moab are excluded. Now, the problem that surfaced about David is, David is a great grandchild of Rus, who is a Moabite convert. The Torah says Moabite converts are not allowed to become Jews. David, therefore, is a descendant of this ineligible person. He himself, therefore, is not allowed to marry into Klal Yisrael. The reason why it's not a problem in the halachic system is we have a peculiar drasha here. And that is, the prohibition against the Moabite is only the male Moabite and not the female Moabite. We darshan Moavi velo Moavit, Amoni velo Amonit. Therefore, Rus was halachically legitimate. Therefore, David, even as a male descendant of a female proselyte, would also be halachically legitimate. However, we will see that over and over again, this was not a halacha that was widely known. The reason is very simple. There were very few Moabites who ever wanted to convert. You know, like how many Nazis, you know, became Jews? Not that many, although I understand there are one or two that tried. But the point is this.
Yeah.
No, okay. Right.
And that's because the woman has a harder contact
with
the children.
Right.
So if that is true, how could a Moabi not have had as much poisonous impact as her?
Yes, so the Gemara gives the answer, because the criticism that they did not go out and offer the Jews food and water would only apply to the men who might be expected to meet a foreign army, and not the women who could not be expected to do so because of tzniyos. Although here we have a very fascinating idea. I mean, we're saying the women cannot be condemned for failing to give water because it is not modest for women to go out to a foreign army and give them water. Now, obviously, the reason the Moabite women did not come out was not because of tzniyos, because we find in the Chumash that they later came out and they enticed the Jewish people with promiscuity. So you see from here an interesting thing, I think you see from here that if you do the right thing, even if it's totally for the wrong reasons, it still counts. Meaning to say, not going out was a proper behavior of tzniyos. Aye, that had nothing to do with their motives. So what? They did the right thing, you know. So, but that undermines your point. But your point is that the emotional cruelty, as it were, would still be there. Yeah. Now, Kabbalistically, that doesn't explain it totally, but it explains Rusk. It does say that Lot absorbed certain holiness from his connection with Abraham. And that holiness was imprisoned. And in Rusk, it was a spark that emerged. But again, that doesn't explain the whole thing, because that might explain Rusk. According to the halakha, all Moabite women are permitted, not only Rus. But the point I want to say is this. This was a halakha that was forgotten again and again, and according to Chazal, the accusations against David's lineage resurfaced in the lifetime of Shaul and after the death of Shaul as well. Because remember, David had many enemies. There were still pockets of the tribe of Binyamin that were making civil wars, remember Ishbosheth and the like. And Shmuel wrote the book of Rus to put the matter at rest. How? Because Boaz was a great man. Boaz was a leader of the generation. And by recording that Boaz married Rus the Moabite, that gives the imprimatur of precedence that this was halachically legitimate. Right? So, in a very simple way, although there are many beautiful lessons about Megillas Rus, and we'll talk about what those lessons are, in a very simple way, this was designed to be a legal document that established the legitimacy of the Yichus of David HaMelech. This explains why Shmuel has a very curious omission in the story. Because according to Chazal, it's not recorded here, Boaz was already a very old man, actually was married to Rus exactly one night. He married Rus, he consummated the marriage, and he was dead the next morning. Now, Shmuel Hanavi leaves out that detail. Now, you understand why he left out that detail. Because people would say, what? People might very well assume, yeah, the reason Boaz died is because he was not allowed to do what he did, and that proves it was a prohibited union. Now, Shmuel knew that that wasn't the reason. We'll discuss why Boaz died when he died. He was actually very old, and the truth is he should have died years before. God kept him alive so that he would be with Ruth. But Shmuel figured, why put in something that would confuse people and miss the point? But that's why even the omission, as it were, is very telling, because the omission, because putting it in would undermine the very significance of the point. Yeah.
Naomi was his mother.
Naomi was whose mother? Boaz? No. Naomi was the mother-in-law of Ruth. Boaz. We're not told who Boaz's mother was. No, Boaz was the judge who married Ruth at the very end of the story. I'm looking at the end of the story, not the beginning. Yeah. Well, no, Yishai was not married to a Moabite woman. Yishai was married to a regular Jewish woman. But there is, we'll discuss it. At the end of his life, he separated from his wife and he was with a Canaanite servant. Yeah. Okay, so now, why we read Ruth on Shavuos is a different question than why the book of Ruth was written. The book of Ruth was written primarily to validate the legal lineage of David HaMelech. Why we read Ruth on Shavuos, there are many reasons. One reason is that it is connected with David HaMelech indeed, because David HaMelech, it is said, was born on Shavuos and died on Shavuos. Yeah, that's one reason. Another reason is that the story of Ruth is the story of how a woman willingly accepted upon herself the yoke of God's commandments, and that is a message to us. As we accept the Torah, we too must accept upon ourselves those commandments like Ruth did. And number three, Ruth is also an example of the kindness and chesed that she showed towards her mother-in-law. And this teaches us that the Torah is acquired only by the attribute of loving kindness. Those are the basic three. And of course, the fourth reason is a seasonal reason, that the story of Ruth happens between the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. And that's exactly the period of time between Pesach and Shavuos, right? So those are different reasons. But we have to keep in mind two different questions. Why the book of Ruth was written and why the Takana was to read it on the day of Shavuos. If I had to guess, I'm going to decide that the primary reason is probably because Matan Torah itself represents the conversion of the Jewish people, and therefore we connect it to the conversion of Rus as a prototype of the selfless commitment to the ways of God, which we see from Rus. Also, it's a very important lesson, how unracist Judaism is. You know, racism is the notion that who you are is a function of your birth. Right? You can be in Japan. If you're a Korean who's in Japan for 300 years, you're still a foreigner. I mean, that's the concept of how tight, the racial identity is. And here we see a woman comes from the hated nation of Moab. And not only is she welcomed, but in fact she is the ancestor of David HaMelech, who is the ancestor of Mashiach. Right? So our Redeemer comes from the one who embraces. So we're not a racist. It's not a function of birth. It's a function of what your commitments are. And that's a very important lesson of Matan Torah. Now, you know that according to the Vilna Gaon, the obligation to read Megillas Rus on Shavuos is as strong as the obligation to read the Megillah on Purim. So the Vilna Gaon Shita is that you read the Megillas from a parchment, just like Megillas Esther, and you make a bracha, al mikra Megillah. The Vilna Gaon Shita is for Shir HaShirim, and Koheles, and Rus, and Eicha. As you know, our custom is not that way. Our custom is that we only make a bracha and use a parchment for Megillas Esther, and we do not treat Rus, for example, as an absolute obligation. We treat it as a long-standing custom for which we do not make a bracha. So there are different machlokes about that. Okay, so maybe we'll stop here and we'll continue next week. So have a good day.